My name is Michael Pellet, and I teach theology at the Lutheran Theological Seminary in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, Canada. And this week, here at Holden Village, I'll be teaching an overview on liberation theology, some of the topics and themes in liberation theology. And today, what I'd like to do is just give a general introduction or overview to why the theology of liberation came about, or at least in my interpretation of how I see some of that happening. And also the second thing I would like to do is one of the emphases that they have is that within the situation of the people, of the poor and oppressed, they talk about reading scriptures or rereading scriptures from their context, from their situation. So what I would like to do for at least half of our session today is look at some of these passages and reread scripture, if you will, from the context of the poor, the oppressed, from the context of, to generalize it, the two-thirds world, and see if maybe they're reading some passages of scripture differently than we are, and if context does have something to do with the way that we read and interpret. To start it off, and to get the general setting, I'd like to go all the way back to kind of the history of theology in the 19th and 20th century, and starting with that key year that I'm sure you all remember well, 1799. And as I've summarized it here so I won't ramble, I've said in 1799 in Berlin, Friedrich Schleiermacher published a book entitled On Religion, Speeches to the Cultured Despisers. The purpose of the book was to show and to convince the cultured, the elite, the philosophical advocates of Immanuel Kant, the literary giants such as Goethe, the romanticists like Schlegel, that Christianity was essential to the cultured enterprise. That in fact, the possibility for any human thinking or doing was grounded in an immediate awareness or consciousness of God. What good is Christianity? Sneered the cultured despisers. Why, it shows us how every human enterprise, even our very consciousness and awareness, is ultimately dependent upon God, was Schleiermacher's response. That book and the reaction to it set one major agenda question for the remainder of the 19th and for most of the 20th century. What good is Christianity? Asked Ludwig Feuerbach. His answer? It is merely the projection of human subjectivity as it strives to transcend itself. That sounds impressive just to listen to it, doesn't it? What good is Christianity? Asked Karl Marx. It is an opiate for the people, used by the bourgeoisie to keep the minds of the proletariat focused on otherworldly concerns and hopes, and not focused on the suffering and alienation they undergo due to the ownership of the means of production. What good is Christianity? Asks Sigmund Freud. It is a system devised to repress the desires of the human being into the recesses of the subconscious, often leaving one with severe psychological problems and guilt. To every challenge that arose, Christian theologians would counter and often offer their own counterattacks. And so the verbal volleys, conceptual concepts, philosophical forays continued. From the midst of that battle, a group of theologians, mostly from Latin America, emerge and ask us all to reconsider this major question. Why? Because according to their claim, it's the wrong question to ask. They contend that we should not be asking what good is Christianity, but rather for whose good is Christianity? For whom does the God of the Judeo-Christian tradition act? Indeed, there's no reason to bother asking what good is Christianity unless we first know whether or not Christianity is for someone's good at all. This question, for whose good is Christianity, takes us back to the scriptures. Theologians of liberation say that we must search the scriptures because in them we find the answer to the question, for whom is God good? One event which stands out from their reading of scripture that shows God's goodness is the Exodus event. Here God chooses a poor, oppressed people, frees them from bondage to the Egyptians, is with them in their wanderings, and establishes them as a nation. God is a deliverer, a liberator. For whom is God good? The poor and the oppressed Hebrew people. Throughout the history of Israel, the voices of the prophets continue to remind the people that God sides with the poor. The widow, the orphan, the traveler, the indentured servant are those for whom God cares, and they are not to be oppressed or exploited by those to whom prosperity has been given. Rather, as God's instruments of peace, justice, love, deliverance, the prosperous ones are to help the poor in every and any way they can. They must take the side of the poor, just as God does. In the words of the prophet Micah, what God desires is that we do justice and love kindness and walk humbly with our God. With the coming of Christ, we see again in most dramatic ways for whom God, and certainly following from Christ, for whom Christians are to be good. The ministry of Jesus indicates that it is not the Romans, the imperialist conquerors of Judea and the world, who are Jesus' major audience, nor is it the Jewish aristocracy, the Sadducean bankers, merchants, and priests who come clamoring to Jesus. But again, it is the poor, the crowds, comprised of the sick, the lame, the dying, the prostitutes, and sinners. In Luke's gospel, Jesus cites a passage from Isaiah as summarizing his ministry. This is in Luke 4. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed. For whose good is God? And for whose good is the Christian faith? These theologians of liberation respond, as we read the scriptures, we see God acting as a deliverer, as a liberator of the poor and the oppressed people. In fact, it seems as if God chooses to be on their side. God demonstrates a preferential option for them. The theological process then becomes embodied into the process of liberation. Where the poor and oppressed in this world are struggling to be seen, recognized, and respected as human persons, there is where the good news of Jesus must be, struggling and suffering with them. Christian theology, liberation theology, and again, for liberation theologians, there's no difference between Christian theology and liberation theology. If it is going to be Christian, it must be liberation theology. This Christian theology becomes a liberating force which tends to contribute to the total understanding of salvation in Jesus, which takes place in the actions of real life. The theology of liberation does not intend to provide Christian justification for positions already taken, and does not aim to be a revolutionary Christian ideology. On the other hand, this theology of liberation does not pretend to be ethically neutral. In fact, it sees the stance of neutrality as actually part of ruling class ideology. All right, let me read that again. That's a controversial point. The theology of liberation does not pretend to be ethically neutral. In fact, it sees the stance of neutrality as actually part of ruling class ideology. Neutrality is a hidden commitment to the status quo. Liberation theology is advocacy, and advocacy for the poor and oppressed. Liberation theology, as good Christian theology, takes the side which God, by preference, has always and already taken. Okay. Enough of that. The thing here, again, the distinction between what good and for whose good. As you can see, as soon as we ask this question, for whose good, the whole focus of theology, the whole focus of the question shifts simply from a notion of intellectual content and argument into a whole understanding not only of that kind of content and argument, but a notion of action and relationships. In other words, how does one enact, embody, put the Christian faith into practice, or to use one of the Latin roots for the terms and one of the more technical terms they use, praxis. When you ask the question for whose good, you're talking about praxis, you're talking about action, you're talking about doing something, and doing something which is going to lead to certain kind of relationships. And very simply put again, those kinds of relationships are relationships which can lead to either justice and freedom, or they can lead to things like injustice and oppression. Therefore, when you ask this question, for whose good, within a context where the structure of the relationships are unjust, oppressive structures, you can see by asking that question, for whose good, you're also going to say, well, if it is for the good of those who are poor and oppressed and suffer injustice, that also means that the action which follows from that is going to change relationships in such a way that structures are also going to be changed. Structures of injustice and oppression are going to be changed for or toward structures of justice and freedom. And you can see now perhaps why, for many people, particularly those who have had advantages coming to them from unjust and oppressive structures, find liberation theology, which wants to change those structures, a very threatening kind of thing, and will do all in their power to stop it. And therefore it becomes, as you can see, again, when one talks about relationships, one is also talking about the political dimension of life. Because it's within the political dimensions of our life that we build most of our relationships. We can talk about community. Community in terms of the cities or towns in which we live. Holden Village is community, but that is also a village that has politics going on within it, structures, relationships, and so on and so forth. Are they just and freeing? Are they unjust and oppressive? Well, that's a good question we can talk about. But that is one of the issues, one of the overarching issues, and this is the overarching question, I think, that sets the context for those who want to do liberation theology. Okay, let me just stop here for a second to see if there are any questions, comments, reactions.
Well, I was, for a while, I really, as a student of theology, I struggled for a good while with the notion of liberation theology as an ideology, you know, as a kind of Marxist ideology or something like that, as kind of embodying that kind of ideology. But I think, you know, especially in the way you were describing it before, it's really very erroneous to think of it in that way, because the way you were describing it in terms of one is either neutral toward other people, just kind of taking a position of neutrality and indifference and kind of letting things move the way nature takes them, kind of survival of the fittest type of, you know, view of nature, or you have a notion of justice, you have a notion of what God's will is for human beings, and you act upon what you understand God's will to be for us. And so, you know, the traditional notion of democratic justice as rule of the majority totally fails that kind of expectation in terms of what God's will is, you know, the expectation of justice. And so I guess, you know, for me to have originally been thinking of liberation theology in terms of my traditional education as some kind of ideological or application of Marxist ideology or socialist thought to Christian theology is erroneous, and really I think a better understanding of liberation theology is the application, the carrying out of God's will in the context of politics and economics and social actions. And that would not be able to be embodied in any ideology. It could not be. But it would have to be acted out, carried out in a very concrete way, in terms of the demands of the times, in terms of the needs of the people in any given context, so that you couldn't possibly describe liberation theology as a purely economic thing, or as a purely social, you know, reaching out to the poor. I mean, it might not be, the oppressed might not be poverty-stricken people in a given context. They might be socially oppressed. They might be a particular minority group that might not be particularly poverty-stricken, but has great needs. You know, and so it seems to me that that's the way to kind of look at the whole subject of liberation theology.
Three comments. First, with regard to Marxism and liberation theology, I'm going to treat that as a topic in and of itself on Wednesday. So in terms of saying more about that, I'll say more about that on Wednesday. Secondly, that's right. The notion of those who are poor and oppressed are not necessarily confined to those who are just poverty-stricken. I think liberation theology is an umbrella term that includes much of the theologies that we find within the two-thirds world or the third world, but as well it includes black theology and theologies for other people of color, feminist theology, gay lesbian theology, because in some respects all of those people fall under that broad rubric of oppression, domination, that the relationships there and the structures there are not those which foster justice and freedom and well-being for all human beings. And so in that sense, liberation theology is a broad term. I'm just, again, focusing basically on the Latin American situation and for the sake of narrowing the topic a bit and keeping it manageable. So those three things. Any other questions, comments? Okay, let's look a little bit at some of the passages from Scripture. Roman numeral 2 on the handout sheet here about reading the Scriptures from the perspective of for whose good. And again, we won't have the opportunity to look at all of them, but just a few to make some points. The first one I'd like to look at is the Exodus 3, verses 7 to 22. Again, as I said, the Exodus event is seen as a central event for understanding how God acts as a liberator, as a deliverer, as one who saves. And to just set the context for that, in chapter 3, verses 7 and 8, and again, the Bible I'm reading from is an RSV translation. And that reads, "Then the Lord God said, I have seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, Hittites," and you know all those ites. And also the end about this. The other thing is that, you know, when we're talking about action and relationships and praxis, this is not idealistic kind of Pollyannish stuff either. The real realities of these things come through. Verse 19 and following of chapter 3. I mean, you know, again, God is not a dummy and understands what's going on. God says, "I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless compelled by a mighty hand. So I will stretch out my hand and smite Egypt with all the wonders which I will do in it. After that, he will let you go. And I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, and when you go up, you shall not go empty. But each woman shall ask of her neighbor and of her who sojourns in her house jewelry of silver and of gold and clothing, and you shall put them on your sons and on your daughters. Thus you shall despoil the Egyptians." Well, if you're going to change structures, right? It's not a pretty picture. Right? Think of all those despoiled Egyptians out there. I mean, it's not a pretty picture for the oligarchy of El Salvador to picture themselves as despoiled. And so, why not have a few death squads? Right? I mean, if you don't want to be despoiled, one has to, right, react in kind. Or it's not a pretty picture for those of us in the United States when we start thinking seriously about what liberation for the other two-thirds world might mean and what that could do to our cost of living and the way we're used to living. And therefore, since we do not want to be despoiled Egyptians, we react in kind, like sending arms and military aid and getting mercenaries to fight, so that the structures and the relationships don't have to change. That's where the crunch comes. And it is a crunch. And the other understanding, again, from the perspective of these theologians of liberation, why would these Hebrew people take the gold and the silver and the jewelry and the clothing? Well, in terms of justice, by rights, it was theirs anyway. Right? They were the ones who worked for it, but it was the Egyptians who got it all from slave labor, from taking advantage of them. And that again becomes the controversial point, that when these structures and these relationships change, right? Again, for whose good and to whom do goods belong? To switch the context a little bit, James Cone, in his book God of the Oppressed, puts in an incident once where a black woman who is a maid in a rich white person's home, right, picks up any leftover money that she finds out on the dresser or jewelry or anything, she picks that up and puts that in her pocket. And then one day she's caught and the woman of the house asked her, "Well, why are you stealing from me?" And her response is, "I ain't stealing from you. I'm just taking what's mine." If she would have taken that from another black woman, she would have been stealing. But not from the white woman. That's not stealing. That's just taking what is rightfully hers. Now, does that jibe with your particular understanding of values and ethics and morality? You can see there's a perspectival difference, a shift, different structures that are at work here. Another one, Deuteronomy chapter 26. And in Deuteronomy chapter 26, we have here an injunction and a remembrance in terms of offerings, and again a time of remembering when Israel is delivered. And this is the offering of the first fruits. And in verses 5 and following of chapter 26, what we have before us, if you will, is the prayer that the person making the offering is supposed to make. And note again how this brings them into the understanding of covenant and into the understanding of deliverance, and how it shifts in terms of not simply a question of, well, what good was the Exodus, but for whose good was the Exodus? And the answer to that is, it was good for me. And note the shift in the pronouns from third person to first person singular. I'll kind of point that out as we go along. Verse 5 and following. "And you shall make response before the Lord your God. A wandering Aramean was my father, and he went down into Egypt." Okay, talking here about Jacob and family, right? Here's our third person kind of historical accounting. "He went down into Egypt and sojourned there, few in number, and there he became a nation, great and mighty and populous. And the Egyptians treated us harshly." Note the switch already. Already now, if you will, talk about solidarity, to say what happened to my ancestors in Egypt is also something that I should remember and incorporate as well. I am on the side of those who are oppressed and dominated. I am always on that side because that's the side God is on, right? "The Egyptians treated us harshly and afflicted us, and laid upon us hard bondage. Then we cried to the Lord, the God of our fathers. The Lord heard our voice, saw our affliction, our toil, our oppression. The Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and outstretched arm, with great terror, signs, wonders. He brought us into this place, gave us this land, a land flowing with milk, honey. Again, now note the shift in the pronoun. And behold, now I bring the first of the fruit of the ground, which thou, O Lord, hast given me. And you shall set it down before the Lord your God, and worship before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice in all the good which the Lord your God has given to you and to your house, you and the Levite and the sojourner who is among you. Again, those the Levites, the ones who work in the temple, were people who did not have any land or their own personal properties. And so they were to be taken care of by the others. The sojourner, the foreigner, right, the alien, the one who did not necessarily have rights, is yet the one who is to be taken care of. And so again, you see how the covenant and the understanding of deliverance, of liberation, and for whose good is always understood cultically within Israel as not just a past historical event, but it is something which is always present tense. It involves the community now. It happened to us, and therefore it means that I must respond and act and live accordingly. Okay, down to the prophets, to look at Micah chapter 6. And here in Micah chapter 6, what we have again is a complaint by Yahweh, a complaint by God against the people, because the people who should know better, who have lived within the who are to live within the covenant, have not done so.
Mike, for those of you who have the RSV, it's page 805. Black RSV.
And in the beginning of Micah chapter 6, we see the complaint here, the last half of verse 2. For the Lord has a controversy with his people, and he will contend with Israel. O my people, what have I done to you, and what have I wearied you? Is the question God asks in verse 3. And again, note again this understanding of deliverance. For I brought you up from the land of Egypt, and redeemed you from the house of bondage, and I sent before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. O my people, remember what Balak the king of Moab devised, and what Balaam the son of Beor answered him, and what happened from Shittim to Gilgal, that you may know the saving acts, or again, the delivering, the liberating acts of the Lord. But the people had forgotten that and thought that basically God could be appeased through different kinds of offerings, right? Burnt offerings of calves or rams or oil or even even their firstborn son, their children. And in all of that, God is not pleased. Verse 9, again, a key verse here. What does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God? And then again, some of the problems that the prophet Micah sees going on within Israel at the time. Verse 11, shall I acquit the man with wicked scales and with a bag of deceitful weights? In other words, cheating the people at the marketplace. Your rich men are full of violence. Your inhabitants speak lies, and their tongue is deceitful in their mouth. Therefore I have begun to smite you, making you desolate because of your sins. You shall eat but not be satisfied, and there shall be hunger in your inward parts. You shall put away but not save. Right, if you will, inflation is a sign of injustice. and what you save I will give to the sword, and so on and so forth. But again, the notion that injustice among the people, right, is clean contrary to the delivering, salvific, liberating acts of God. Shifting it to the New Testament. To look in that first section, one of the Sabbath healers, to look at Mark chapter 3, verses 1 to 6. Mark 3, 1 to 6, it reads, "Again, Jesus entered the synagogue, and a man was there who had a withered hand, and they watched him to see whether he would heal him on the Sabbath, so that they might accuse him. And he said to the man who had the withered hand, 'Come here.' And he said to them, 'Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or to kill?' But they were silent. And he looked around at them with anger, grieved at their hardness of heart, and said to the man, 'Stretch out your hand.' He stretched it out, and his hand was restored. The Pharisees went out and immediately held counsel with the Herodians against him, how to destroy him." Why the controversy? Have you ever asked yourself the question, why are the Pharisees so hacked off on Jesus when he does such a nice thing? Wouldn't it be nice on Sunday morning to heal a sick person? Why would the Pharisees, I mean, how do you understand that passage? How have you interpreted it? What sermons have you heard on that passage? None, they all preach on the epistle lesson. Ah, come on. As Susan said this morning, that's a cheap answer. Now, what? Why put this particular story in the Bible anyway? Did Mark say, gee, I need six more verses in chapter 3? Yes, please.
Well, in fact, the Pharisees, or the ruling class of the Hebrews, had become so obsessed with laws or regulations that they completely overlooked the humanity and the humane approach to religion. So it didn't matter to him that this poor man had his hand with him. What mattered to them was holding to a very rigid idea of this the Sabbath rule. And apparently at that time, people could even be killed for breaking a very minor point of Sabbath rules.
Okay, but what's wrong with few laws? I mean, you know, we all need law and order. Otherwise, we'd have anarchy, chaos, wouldn't we?
I think they were afraid of losing some of their power. There was a risk there for the Pharisees.
A little risk, losing some power. What kind of power would they lose? I thought Pharisees are holy men of God. What do you mean power?
Well, they probably thought they had some authority, some hold over the people.
Sure.
And they were priests in the temple, or some of them were, teachers, and they were looked upon. And they were taking it. They were afraid.
Sure.
Taking a risk.
Probably the same way you and the rest of the ordained minister would feel if it came about that lay preachers were considered as good or better. How would the hierarchy of the church feel?
Touche. Good for you. That's right. And one has to, you know, as you carry these things out in talking about structures, you have to ask the question, well, why does the ordained clergy person have to preach on Sunday morning? I mean, believe me, I know many instances where there have to be people in the congregation who are better preachers than I do. Okay. Right? I mean, who says clergy should be on the level above laity, right? Clergy laity is already a particular kind of, right, politics, action, structure, relationship. And is that relationship supposed to be a hierarchical relationship, right? Clergy over lay people, right? Or not? Please.
I was just thinking to compare this situation to something similar that might happen today. If someone, this happened in the synagogue. I mean, I was just thinking if someone who was in some way handicapped or something, or maybe even, there were demon-possessed people, you know, the New Testament speaks of demon-possessed people. If someone in the middle of a worship service started ranting and raving, you know, over, you know, someone who the average person would consider psychologically deranged or mentally ill or something, would started disrupting the worship service. And someone, you know, the expected thing would be for maybe an usher or, you know, someone in authority to come along, or someone considered responsible to come along and take the person out of the worship service. And, you know, but what Jesus did here in the synagogue was go in and, I mean, with this man with the withered hand, he just went in and kind of maybe interrupted whatever was going on and healed this man, you know. And it would be similar, say, if Jesus came in, you know, to heal this person of his or her mental illness. It would be considered, what, this is not what should be happening, where he's disrupting this, our, you know, sacred service of worship. You know, and so probably most of the people would be disturbed by what was happening because they're accustomed to a particular tradition which they consider, you know, sacred. You know, and since they consider the particular activity, the particular tradition to be sacred, anyone who would disrupt that and do something different that out of the expected, you know, is unrighteous, is someone who is sacrilegious, you know, and therefore unholy and to be condemned for what he's doing. And so I would see it in that light. In terms of my own experience, I've seen people terribly embarrassed and angry at people from out in the streets who come in and disrupt a worship service. I've seen that happen, and I mean we all have, I think, have seen, you know, drunken people or whatever come in and disrupt a worship service, and we've seen them just ushered out of the worship service. And I'm just thinking that Jesus would have been a person who would have maybe just stopped the service and did something to create a sense of wholeness or acceptance for the person who has come, who is obviously suffering a very traumatic situation in his life.
I think what we're talking about, though, is a threat that goes a lot deeper than a disruption of in the synagogue of a service or a liturgy or anything like that, because the Pharisees are determining how they're going to destroy Jesus. I mean, the threat, I see what you're saying, but I just think the threat goes a lot deeper, and the threat of liberation theology is a lot deeper than just liturgy questions.
Well,
and disrupting a worship service and things like that.
Is that the only option we have here, is total disruption, or there's no way to build part of this new theology into the old, as opposed to destroying one and replacing it with another? I'm not into this at all, but it seems like we're talking about either or here.
That's, I'm not going to answer that question directly, because I think that is simply a question one needs to think about long and hard in terms of what, you know, again, back to this notion of when one changes relationships and when one changes structures, does that mean everything has to go or some things, you know, what, you know, you have to talk about, you know, what can stay, what can, is it an either, a really dramatic either or kind of thing, or is there somewhat of both and? I mean, those are questions that are asked and struggles that go on within and among theologians of liberation themselves. Right? I mean, because those are the tough questions. I mean, that's always in the doing. When you do something and say we want to do it a new way, right, what does that all entail? I mean, there's a lot going on. Yes, please.
It seems to me that if you saw some of the things that the Pharisees do as resulting in them being on the top of the totem pole, Jesus is kind of changing the rules of the game. If everybody plays the game the way they want it, they get to be on top. Jesus now is taking the same rules, interpreting them differently, and undercutting their position of power. So in a sense, it seems like he's going after a major system that legitimizes their self-righteousness without having to be just. And I realize that's a bit of a distortion of Pharisees anyway, but it is.
Right, right. But at least here in this context of power and authority and understanding it, and I think again from the perspective of liberation theology, what's going on here is indeed Jesus is going after a system. Another passage that talks about that, Matthew chapter 23. To look at Matthew 23, verses 2 to 4. You know, again, here Jesus is a little more satirical, cynical. Chapter 23 of Matthew, verses 2 to 4. Jesus says, "The scribes and the Pharisees sit on Moses' seat, so practice and observe whatever they tell you, but do not what they do. For they preach, but do not practice." Right? Again, here the little twist of the thing is, you know, the Pharisees are really telling you some good stuff. You ought to listen to what they say and do it. Just don't follow their example. I mean, in other words, the old cliche, the Pharisees don't practice what they preach. But what do? They bind heavy burdens hard to bear and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with their finger. All right. See, there's the injustice and oppression within the system. The system that says, boy, do you guys have a lot to do. You sinners, you scum, you nasty people, you folks who never keep the 613 laws, you are really bad. I thank God I'm not note that, how that pulls us apart. And that's how I, as Pharisee, clergy, whatever, that's how I can keep power over you. Right? Because I'm okay, you're not okay. That kind of. And here it's the understanding within the whole context of, again, particularly the poor and the oppressed. What goes with this is the whole kind of dehumanizing rhetoric that has told people for centuries, since the conquest of Latin America, that particularly the indigenous people there are what? Not really people. And at best, they're second-class people, second-class human beings. And again, you can see the umbrella term of liberation. Look at all the people who are asking for rights, who are asking to be accepted as human beings today. Right? One of the distinctions is that, right, that those who are in power are always saying, well, you know, they're not really human. Right? We all know men are better than women. So we need feminists to say, no, that's not right. We all know whites are better than blacks. So we need some black theologians to say that's not the case. We all know heterosexuals are better than homosexuals. So you need some of those from the gay lesbian community to say, no, we're human beings too. Right? That whole dehumanizing rhetoric and action that goes with it. And when you keep that going for centuries, right, and you build that into the structures and the systems, you come up with things like apartheid, where people are going to argue really that what, by nature, God created blacks to be inferior to whites. That's their purpose in creation, to serve the white race. And as you read within the literature earlier on, there were, again, people who would argue that the indigenous people of Latin America, of Central and South America, were like beasts. In fact, Juan de Sepulveda even argues that as far as he's concerned, he doesn't think the natives have souls. So you can treat them like mules, because after all, if they have souls, they aren't any different than a mule, are they? Only the European people, only the white people had souls. So it's nice that some people within the Catholic Church would be charitable and come and baptize them and bury them, but really, they are simply beasts of burden. They are soulless. They are not human beings. That's the whole demonic side of this system and this structure. And that's the particular thing that Jesus is getting at right here. When these Pharisees are silent, it's the same response that Jesus that comes when Jesus wants to cast out demons in Mark's gospel. Right? The demons say, I know who you are. And Jesus says to the demon, be silent. And so here again, the demonic comes in the Pharisees who are silent, that demonic structure. One more biblical passage, and that's Luke chapter 20, verses 19 to 26. Again, I think a passage many of us are familiar with. Luke 20, 19 to 26. The scribes and the Pharisees and chief priests tried to lay hands on him at that very hour, but they feared the people, for they perceived that he had told this parable against them. So they watched him, sent spies, pretended to be sincere, that they may take hold of what he said, so as to deliver him up to the authority and jurisdiction of the governor. They ask him, Teacher, we know that you speak and teach rightly. Show no partiality, but truly teach the way of God. Is it lawful for us to give tribute to Caesar or not? But he perceived their craftiness and said to them, Show me a coin. Whose likeness and inscription has it? They said, Caesar's. He said to them, Then render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. And they were not able in the presence of the people to catch him by what he said, but marveling at his answer, they were silent. Okay, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God's the things that are God's. What does that passage tell us to do? Right. Some things belong to God, some things belong to the state, so a good Christian citizen pays their taxes, right? That's the interpretation of that passage, often that we've been told. But think a little more about this. Render to Caesar the things that belong to Caesar's, to God's what belong to God, what belongs to God. What things belong to Caesar? What things are rightfully Caesar's?
Nothing.
Nothing. So what should you give Caesar?
Nothing.
Nothing. Give him the old Bronx cheer, is what Jesus is telling these folks. And I will contend that is not an outlandish statement or an interpretation. And the Pharisees and all these folks knew that full well. Verse chapter 23, right, they bring Jesus before Pilate, chapter 23, verse 1. Then the whole company of them arose and brought him before Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, We found this man perverting our nature and forbidding us to give tribute to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ the King. Right? They understood what Jesus was saying. Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar. Give Caesar nothing. The reason the Pharisees were, you know, marveled at Jesus' shrewdness is because Jesus did not give them a brilliant intellectual answer. Jesus gave them a brilliant political answer, right? For whose good is tribute supposed to be? Well, if all it's doing is just stuffing Caesar's pockets so that Tiberius can live so nicely on Capri, nothing for that guy. Doesn't need it. Shouldn't get it. It doesn't belong to him. A very volatile political statement. And the scribes and Pharisees and chief priests and all those folks knew it. That's why they were silent again at that response. Not because they said, oh gee, I guess now we gotta go home and pay our taxes. That wasn't it at all. You see, that highlights, again, the political impact of the gospel and the changing of these kinds of relationships. And this is how these theologians of liberation are reading or rereading scriptures from the eyes of the poor and the oppressed. Okay, I think our time's up. I'll be glad to answer questions if you have them. We can take it up again tomorrow. We'll start at the end of this tomorrow before we go into the section of looking more closely at the distinction between the poor and poverty. In other words, there is a distinction there. God isn't calling us all to a life of poverty. So don't sell everything you own tonight. Or if you are interested in selling it, I'm always willing to receive it.
What was your intention with the fire contract?